I read this passage this evening because I want to speak about the one who was called the English Josiah, speaking of Edward VI, the King of England. It was just after midnight on the morning of January 28, 1547, thus in the middle of the winter, that England's King Henry VIII lay dying in his palace of Whitehall in London, long before Buckingham Palace was even conceived. Gathered around the king were a number of his advisors and chief members of his court. The king's grossly obese body displayed many marks of the life of dissipation he had led. He became, in more ways than one of those larger-than-life figures on the pages of history. He had been married 6 times. By his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, he had 6 children, but only one, the Princess Mary, survived past infancy. That was not uncommon at all in that time. His second wife, Anne Boleyn, gave birth only to the Princess Elizabeth. Before being executed on the trumped-up charges of adultery and treason. And since Henry's first wife had died during that time, then it was judged that he was free to marry whoever he wanted. And so he took a third wife. And his third wife, whose name was Jane Seymour, presented him with that for which the king longed, a son. If they could only have waited till now, the other part of the announcement today was that if a daughter is the firstborn to a royal couple, that daughter would not be precluded from governing herself as the monarch. But in the whole history of the United Kingdom, the preference has been to have a male on the throne, and Henry wanted that for the consolidation of his family on the throne. But the problem was that though the queen seemed to have survived the childbirth quite well and took part in a number of the activities following that, just 11 days after her son Edward was born, she became ill. The doctors of that time probably didn't know what to make of it, except that it was something to do with having given birth. Whether it was an infection that she contracted in the less than sanitary conditions, or whether it was some sort of a hemorrhage, no one knows. But she died just 12 days after giving birth to Edward, and the king was shattered. But not enough to stop him from marrying 3 more wives. He had been famous for his wild living. Drinking had been one of his favorite pastimes. Eating, obviously, was another, along with participation in hunts and other recreations. Now, Henry VIII was a very capable monarch, a good administrator, one who worked for the benefit he believed of his family and his kingdom. But he had come to die. And the man who sat in the same room with him, near the deathbed, was Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had been Henry's chief assistant in separating the Church of England from the papacy, in creating somewhat of an anomaly, because the English Church under Henry was still Roman Catholic, but it was no longer under the control of the Pope. Cranmer had been disappointed that he had not been able to push the Reformation beyond that separation, and that indeed so many who had followed in the Reformation path had run afoul of Henry's pleasure and laws and had been put to death. Indeed, as Cranmer sat in that dark room, listening to the king's labored and raspy breathing, some of Cranmer's friends were sleeping not far away in the Tower of London, which besides being a residence for royalty was also a prison. And those who were there were being held there for no other crime than for refusing to submit to Henry's brand of Romanism or to any brand of Romanism. One of them was the aged Hugh Latimer, already past 70 years of age. Memories of other members of that group at Cambridge University, known as the Scripture Men, must have been vivid in Cranmer's mind. Many of them had already been put to death as a direct result of Henry's actions. Where next for England? Even as Henry struggled for his final breaths, the members of his council were consulting in the same room, whispering to each other of their dismay that the heir to the throne was only 9 years old. He was Prince Edward, Henry's only surviving son. What would become of the land under the leadership of a 9-year-old boy? But it was their mistake then, as it would be that of others afterward, to underestimate the young crown prince. It's quite amusing in reading the history of the time. You can tell the biases of the writers almost immediately by whether they seek to take into account Edward's accomplishments or whether they seek to minimize him and dismiss him as a puny little boy who really didn't know anything, and the government was run by others. Not for 3 days after King Henry's death was the fact announced that he was dead. And that was so that those who were in the council could ensure that there would be no question about the succession, and so that they could get the young prince and bring him into the Tower of London for his own safety. Now, there weren't reporters. There was no 24-hour news cycle. There were no press conferences so that people could ask the king's physicians, what about his condition? There were no medical bulletins, so no one in the public at large really knew that the king was dying. So there was a public announcement. The king is dead. Long live the king. Prince Edward, along with his uncle, who was named as the Lord Protector, rode into the Tower of London. His uncle was Edward Seymour. Edward, unlike his sister Jane, was sympathetic, at least we could say, to the Protestant Reformation. He had his own reasons. Mainly they were related to his desire to be powerful. But he was sympathetic to the Protestant Reformation, whereas Edward's mother was not. She was a true Romanist. But subsequent events showed Edward Seymour to be anything but noble, and eventually he ended up losing his life as a result. It was not until 19 days after the death of the king that his body was laid to rest in St. George's Chapel at Windsor Castle. And 3 days later, Edward VI made his processional entrance into London for his coronation. He wore robes, remember, a 9-year-old boy now. He wore robes of silver cloth embroidered with gold thread, and a belt and cap that glittered with rubies, pearls, and diamonds. His horse was attired in crimson satin. And as the boy rode through the streets of what was assuredly then a much smaller capital than it is now, the people cheered him. They referred to him as a young King Solomon, come to restore ancient truth and to do away with heathen rites and detestable idolatry. The following day, the 20th of February, 1547, Edward was crowned in Westminster Abbey. They decorated the abbey lavishly for the occasion. Of course, there were no electric lights. There was no heat. It was the middle of winter. It was, in many ways, a cold building. But it was the first coronation in nearly 40 years. So they hung tapestries from the arches of the abbey. And the king himself was dressed in splendid luxury. A gown of silver, not something that looked like silver, but a gown of silver, embroidered with rubies and diamonds, belted with white velvet and silk, and over his gown a cloak of white velvet, threaded with Venetian silver. He was seated in the famous coronation chair, which is still used to this day, and he was presented with 3 swords to symbolize his 3 kingdoms, and was given 3 crowns to symbolize those kingdoms, England, Ireland, and France. But he demanded a 4th sword to be brought. He asked for the sword of the Spirit. He said that the Bible was to be preferred before the other swords, because there was no other sword like it. He said, it ought in all right to govern us. Without it, we are nothing and can do nothing. He that rules without it is not to be called God's minister or a king. We could do with some of that sentiment in the world these days. Trumpets echoed in the nave of the abbey, and Archbishop Cranmer placed the 3 crowns upon his head. And after the ceremony finally concluded, and they had shortened it because they said, after all, he's a 9-year-old boy, he's going to get bored, then the young king rode his horse through the streets to the Palace of Whitehall, greeting his subjects with great solemnity. As he rode along, it was not what you would have expected from a 9-year-old boy. But King Edward VI was not your basic 9-year-old. Quickly he came to be called the English Josiah, and expectations developed among English Protestants that Edward VI would advance the work of the Reformation that hadn't been only haltingly advanced to that point. One man said of him, how happy are we Englishmen of such a king, in whose childhood appeareth as perfect grace, virtue, godly zeal, desire of literature, gravity, prudence, justice, and magnanimity, as hath heretofore been found in kings of most mature age. It was an auspicious beginning to what would be tragically a very brief reign. There were some in the time following Edward's death who tried to depict him as somewhat sickly all along. But aside from a serious illness that he contracted when he was 4 years old, he really was not any different than most other boys. Now, his father was very solicitous of his health. In fact, his father said, in Edward is the crown jewel of the kingdom. And so his father ordered that the walls of Edward's rooms were to be washed down thoroughly 3 times every day. So servants came in and they washed all the walls. And a few hours later they came back and did it again. And a few hours later they did it again, and the next morning they started all over again. And Henry's idea was whatever pestilence was in the air would not be allowed to adhere to the walls and be breathed in by Edward. So that was some of the care that his father took for him. His reign was a most important one. It marked the time when the Protestant Reformation became well established in England. The time when the seeds were planted that would lead to the English colonization of the New World. And here's one of the things I want you to see tonight, the importance of this boy's time on the throne. It ensured that those who came to the New World from England in the following century would be Protestants, that the colonization of the New World would be done by English Protestants, not by Roman Catholics. It would be the religion of Edward VI, not the religion of Mary I, that they would bring with them to the New World. Now the young king seemed to be aware that he had been called by God to his nation's throne at that exact moment in history to do a great work, just as Josiah was in the passage that we read this evening. Edward pursued this work persistently. England, during his time, was changed. And because of that change, the world was changed. You think of the world tonight. In the centuries since the Reformation era, think of the world tonight if North America had been populated by those who were Roman Catholic. The outlook for liberty, the outlook for the defense of liberty all around the world would have been much different. The importance of that fact in the development of American liberty and constitutional government is really one of the legacies of Edward's reign. And of course, England's colonies in other parts of the world would be Protestant as well. And that was also of great importance. So you see why I want to refer to this king tonight as the boy who changed the world. The boy who changed the world. Now, let's remember, we're talking about a boy. He was 9 at his coronation. Now, he had a lot of advantages that other 9-year-old boys of his time did not have, that's for sure. But he was still 9 years old. Of course, in that time, by the time most children had reached the age of 9, they had had a lot of experience dealing with sickness and death and privation. There were a number of adults who tried to influence Edward, some with success. But he never lost sight of one reality. He was the king. His father had taught him that one day he would be the king and that he should act as the king. And he knew there was a great work for him to do for his people. He became, and we'll explore the reasons for this reality shortly, he became a passionate Protestant. That was much to the delight of Cranmer and Latimer and others. It was more than the result on Edward's part, or even on the part of those who were in the regency. It was more than the result of a political calculation. Will right now be better to favor this side opposed to that side? Edward came to loathe all that the Roman Catholic Church was about. He wrote several tracts defending the royal supremacy. He was a boy, but he was a gifted writer. And he called for the eradication of abuses that remained within the church. He loved long sermons. And the more complicated the sermon was, the better he liked it. He would take notes of the sermons that he heard, and he would write those notes in Greek, or sometimes in Latin. A number of the reformers, including the age of Latimer, who had been released from prison, preached in his presence, and he took great delight in it. That was really what he considered to be the thing that he enjoyed the most, is to be able to have the members of his court gathered around him and to have across from him, in a pulpit specially made for the purpose, one of the Protestant divines preaching the word of the gospel. It was said that on one occasion he refused to stand on a Bible in order to reach a high shelf. And you have to remember that the Bibles of that period were very thick books. Those who were being persecuted for the truth's sake found in Edward a noble champion. So during his reign, Protestants from all over Europe who were being persecuted came to England. And many Englishmen who had gone into exile during Henry's reign returned home. Now it was not all sweetness and light. For many of the members of the court who had been there during Henry's reign were irritated, sometimes visibly so, by the Protestant sermons, especially the long ones. And they pursued their interests in gambling and drinking and other vices for which the English court was only too well known. You see, they make a lot of what goes on nowadays in the royal family. I can assure you that it's nothing new. Edward himself was drawn into palace intrigues where one party would try to manipulate him against another. And one of those intrigues resulted in the execution of members of his own family, including his uncle, Edward Seymour, and Edward the VI's signature was on the death warrant. But it was in the area of religion, and that's where I want to focus the rest of our time this evening. It was in the area of religion that Edward made the greatest contributions, proved the greatest friend of the Reformation. There was a lot about Edward that we could discuss in the area of foreign affairs, a disastrous military campaign against Scotland, and things of that nature. There's no shortage of that, studying the intrigues in the court. But I want really to focus on Edward in the religious realm, because it was there that he really did change his country and the world. The notorious 6 articles of religion that were enacted under King Henry were repealed. And a number of Protestants were released from imprisonment and even from death sentences. You have to remember that there were people who had been put to death just days before Henry's death had occurred. And there was one case in particular of a man who was to be taken out the next day, January the 29th, and put to death. But when the king died, all those sentences were put on hold. Some Roman Catholics who refused to submit to the wishes of the new king replaced the Protestants that they had previously persecuted. So they took their places in the Tower of London. But Edward followed the policy that Josiah followed. Notice in our Bible reading this evening, the in particular the words that we find in verse 3. For in the 8th year of his reign, while he was yet young, he began to seek after the God of David his father. And Edward followed the same policy. What an example he is for children and young people. Edward didn't wait until he was old. If he had, he would never have done so. He would never have sought after the Lord. While he was young, he sought after the Lord. And he resolved to purge his land from the idolatries that went on there. So laws were passed that abolished masses. The terminology of everything to do with religious service was changed. The Bible was made available much more widely in English so that people could read it. Yes, Tyndale's translation, actually under the name of Coverdale, was being widely disseminated. Services of worship began to be conducted in English, not in Latin. The word of the gospel was being preached freely. And for the first time, songs were put to music and sung by the congregation in the services of worship. Beyond that, souls were being converted to Christ. England was being changed. I want you to see that. That was the key to remember about Edward's reign. England was being changed because under his reign, the gospel was being proclaimed and souls were being converted. And once they had been converted, they were not going to go back to the way things had been. So that not even the reign of Edward's half-sister, Mary Tudor, justly known as Bloody Mary, could prevent the alteration from becoming final. It's a tragedy, as I discussed earlier, that the news that comes today, that the centuries-old law barring anyone married to a Roman Catholic, and think how conveniently easy it will be then to say, well, if you're married to a Roman Catholic and you can be king, why can't a Roman Catholic be king or queen, as the case may be? If that law is going to be repealed, all that does is to tell us that the forces of darkness have never given up in their efforts to undermine that which took place in the days of Edward. Edward himself would have been aghast. He didn't live very long. Eventually, he contracted what later generations would know as tuberculosis. All they knew it as was consumption from respiratory ailment. But I want us this evening, in the few minutes that we have remaining, just to think about four things concerning Edward's life. I want you to think, first of all, about the providence of God in his upbringing. Now, it would be considered a great tragedy, ordinarily, that a little boy would never know his mother at all. Stories like that are very affecting to us. All of the influences that a mother should impart to a little boy, Edward never knew them. Never knew his mother. Didn't have very many years to know his father. But I want you to think about the providence of God here. Because his mother, who was not in sympathy with the agenda of the Protestant reformers, was not around to counteract that agenda. And the Lord's providence provided other influences that would govern the course of Edward's thinking and his faith. His religious education was under the direction of Thomas Cranmer. And Edward profited greatly from thorough instruction across a whole range of disciplines, including music. He learned to play musical instruments. It's hard to imagine where he had the time to do all this. He studied the languages, was fluent in French and in Greek and in Latin, and in English, obviously. He studied mathematics and astronomy. He was a true Renaissance boy. Such was the impact of the Protestant influence on him that by 1549, when he was 12, he had written a treatise on the Pope as the Antichrist. And it was not some juvenile rendering like a seventh grade teacher would see often today. Now, there was another dominant influence that God provided on Edward's early years, and I was very much struck by this again, because, again, we would think nothing could be worse than certain situations. What could be worse than to have as the latest in a succession of stepmothers the sixth wife of Henry VIII? What could be worse than that? His own mother died shortly after giving birth. His first stepmother, Catherine Howard, was put to death. His first stepmother was Anne of Cleves, and she was divorced. His second stepmother, Catherine Howard, was put to death, just as Anne Boleyn had been. Now he comes to the third one, Catherine Parr. Catherine Parr had a couple things that distinguished her. First of all, she outlived Henry VIII, which, considering the others, that's a significant achievement. She was much younger than he, and she was sympathetic to the Reformation. It seems strange to say, does it not, that God used this situation, this sixth queen of Henry, to give Henry's son guidance in the way of biblical truth. But so she did. Edward referred to her, as he never did to either of the others, as his very dear mother. And in September 1546, this was the year before he became king, he wrote to her, "I received so many benefits from you that my mind can hardly grasp." Wiley describes her in his History of Protestantism as a lady of eminent virtue and great intelligence, and was herself well acquainted with the Scriptures. So clearly the influence of Catherine Parr and of Cranmer and those he chose to instruct the young prince was instrumental in bringing this boy to the understanding of the doctrines of the gospel, an understanding, I submit to you, that he had before he was ever crowned king. And they say it doesn't do a lot of good to try to deliver the gospel to those who are young. Notice God's grace to him in his salvation. When Edward was born, what was he taught by his father? The rituals of the Mass. Not only the rituals of the Mass, but penance, good works, and all the rest of it. But as he grew, more and more he cast those things aside and absorbed, no doubt through the influence of his last stepmother, the spirit of the Protestant reformers. So those reformers, when they were able to deal with him, as they were directed to arrange for his instruction, They found him to be a most impressive person in terms of his personal faith. Those who preached at court often, while Edward was king, included Hugh Latimer and John Knox. John Knox. And both of them wrote that they were struck by the thought that here was one who was so young, who displayed such maturity in his understanding of the gospel and of what it meant to trust in Christ. I already spoke about what he said on his coronation day about the Bible. All of this could hardly have been surprising, because his typical practice was to read 10 to 12, not verses, chapters of the Bible every day. Now, I think that I could safely say that if any of you undertook such a regimen for an extended period, you would find your life changed by the experience. So he did. Reading the Bible not just as a literary exercise, but reading the Bible to absorb its content. I already spoke about how he enjoyed hearing lengthy sermons that involved theological subjects. Now, when I say all this about Edward, I have to say that here was a man, here was a boy, who believed in Christ, and yet, as is true with everyone who believes in Christ, his faith did not render him always wise. And there were things that Edward did that he should not have done. His faith did not render him immune to the schemes of the adults that he had in his court. But when Edward came to die, the thing that impressed those who attended him in his last hours was that he had on his lips a prayer that he himself had composed. A prayer for his country. A prayer for the advance of the gospel. A prayer that his country would be preserved from every effort to bring it back into Roman bondage. Let me just notice for you, thirdly, how God prepared Edward for his particular work. As we have said, he was 9 years old. But his father had already seen to it that he would have all the qualities he would need to rule as king. There are people that are sympathetic to the forces who labored against Edward, the forces of Romanism, the forces that would make a comeback in the aftermath of Edward's death, when so many Protestants would be put to death. If you've never read J.C. Ryle's little book, Why Our Reformers Were Burned, I commend it to you. I don't know if it's in print. Banner of Truth put it out, republished it again some years ago in a paperback format. Really is stirring to read it. To read about those who sacrificed their lives. Some were told to flee. And those who were English said, we are called here to serve Christ here. And so they surrendered themselves to be arrested. So there was set against Edward a formidable array of those who were sympathetic to the old order. But Edward's education had provided him with a breadth of personal experience that would enable him to hold his own with those who were much older than he That was important not only with those who advised him. First of all, Edward Seymour, and then later, the one who sought to place Lady Jane Grey on the throne after Edward's death, Northumberland. But in particular, Edward saw his preparation from the Lord in the area in which he wanted to be the most active, and that was the role of religious reformer. And here is why he was called the English Josiah. Because the work that Edward did in his days is still governing the nation, the United Kingdom, to this day. Many of the documents that were put into force in that time are still the basis of worship in the English church to this day. Now, the evangelical understanding that Edward had has largely been lost. But what I'm saying is that his work and the work of Cranmer and others advising him, that work is a work that lasted. And that after the 5 years in which Mary sat on the throne, the last four of which, as I indicate in the program for this weekend, saw 288 Protestants burned at the stake in various locations around England. Even after that period of time, once Mary was dead, and Elizabeth, the other one of the trio, three children of Henry. So Henry, in a way, got his wish that the House of Tudor would continue, but not as he envisioned it. Edward, and then his older half-sisters, Mary and Elizabeth, followed him on the throne. And it was when Elizabeth became queen that everything that Mary had sought to do or to undo was reversed. And the work that Edward had established began then to become the law of the land. Early in 1553, when Edward had been king for 6 years, he fell ill. Respiratory distress was described in various ways. Consumption, the grip, other ways were used as well. But of course there was no understanding of bacterial infection. Tuberculosis is a bacterial infection. There was no understanding of the use of antibiotics. About the only thing they knew to do for people who were ill was to take blood from them. Not to study it, but just to take it. The idea is that the new blood would be better. And all they did in most cases was to hasten the death of the person. Edward saw very soon that he was not going to survive. And so he submitted himself to the sovereign purpose of God and did all that he could in his last weeks of life to ensure that Protestantism would not be able to be eradicated. That is, they set things up in law that were of such a character that it would be very hard to do away with them all. And they were good in what they did. Because when Mary became queen, she was advised again and again, can't do that because of this law. We have to have Parliament meet, we have to repeal that law, and we have to repeal that law, and then you can do what you want to do. It took her over a year in what turned out to be an even briefer reign. It took her over a year to get to where she could round up a lot of the people that she hated. And Cranmer was at the top of the list for what she perceived he had done to her mother, Catherine of Aragon, in enabling Henry to nullify his marriage to her. So they did this work, and then Edward came to die. July 6th, 1553, just 3 months short of his 16th birthday, 15th of his death. And the world looks at that, as many writers have done since then, and said, insignificant. They would be wrong. Because Edward's life and Edward's views concerning religion had great impact in his time. Above all, Edward was one who understood the centrality of Reformed truth, and that is the emphasis upon what Christ has done, not upon what people do. The emphasis upon what Christ has done, and the emphasis upon what it means to be forgiven. That was really one of the crux issues of the Reformation. What does it mean to be forgiven? How do you get the forgiveness of God? Edward, like all of the other Protestants, saw that it was strictly on the basis of God's grace, in and through the merits of Jesus Christ. That was the only way in which Edward or anyone else could know the reality of peace with God and could know the reality of a destiny that awaited in heaven. So Edward had no doubt what was going to happen to him. He may not have known what happened to his father, but he had no doubt what was going to happen to him when he came to die. And those views, by the time of Edward's death, had become well established, rooted down deep, because people had read the Bible for themselves. They read concerning Christ for themselves. And those roots were going down. And Mary could, in all of her efforts to uproot Protestantism, as Bishop Ryle points out, Mary could do no more than confirm all that the people had already found out for themselves. And what do you suppose they thought? When they saw those who had been their esteemed ministers being hauled out to be burned at the stake. There was at least one occasion which I read when the condemned man was brought out, and when the crowd caught sight of him, they began to cheer, to thank God for his testimony. I don't think that was the effect that Mary had in mind. That impact, those roots went down deep. And in another two generations, not even that really, because Edward died in 1553, by the end of that century, the nonconformists, the pilgrims, the separatists, they were coming to understand that they were going to have to do something eventually. When James became the king, they felt that they could no longer live in England under his direct rule, so they went to Holland. And where do you suppose their spiritual roots were? In the work of Edward the Sixth. And they would be the ones that would take that gospel message with them across the ocean to an unknown world, to a new world. And there, they would begin to preach the very same message, that salvation is only by grace, through the merits of Christ, the English Josiah. We read at the end of 2 Chronicles 34, the end of the last verse, "And all his days they departed not from following the Lord, the God of their fathers." There's a bit of a sad irony there, because when Josiah's days were ended, there was a departure. So it came to pass ultimately that the Reformation of the 16th and 17th centuries became the foundation for departure. People turned away from it. But we may thank God tonight that not all did. Edward's life is bearing fruit to this hour. Here we are, a congregation of English-speaking Protestants. And we are here, I can tell you, in large measure because of a young boy who was put into an unusual position. And he saw God's calling to him in that place and used that to change the world.